This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. There are hundreds of thousands of plant species, and as different as they may look, there are basic parts they all share. Roots, stems, leaves, flowers, fruits, and seeds. But why are there so many varieties? How do they work, and where did they come from? Jonathan Wilson is assistant professor of biology at Haverford College, where he studies the evolution of plants. Jonathan Wilson, welcome to Living Lab.
Well, thanks for having me.
A lot of your research centers around gaining insight from extinct plants, from fossils of plants. Let's talk about those fossils for a minute, though, because how do they even form? What is left of a plant fossil?
So plant fossils can form in a whole variety of different ways. Plant fossils tend to be preserved well anywhere where there's mud or volcanic activity or any sort of unusual burial environment. Anybody who's composted their yard or raked their leaves knows that over the course of a winter, most of the plant material will actually be decayed and it will disappear. But a small bit of it actually enters the fossil record. So, a good log that ends up in a stream that gets buried by mud or a nearby volcanic eruption that preserves it. And what we get preserved in the fossil record is basically a record of morphology. We get leaves, we get seeds, we have shape and form, and we also have anatomy. Sometimes we get the insides of plant fossils preserved, the insides of leaves, the insides of trunks, and we have a really long record of plants that goes far back. It goes back about 475 million years. And so my work is to explore and study this record and see what we can learn about these long extinct plants by putting them back together.
Do we have fewer plant fossils than animal fossils? I mean, it just seems like it's easier to imagine preserving bone than preserving a leaf because, as you say, they could just compost away.
Yeah, that's actually the relative amount of plant fossils versus animal fossils is actually a difficult thing to constrain, and it sort of comes down to what do you mean by a plant fossil? We have a really long record of invertebrate fossils, of things that make shells and things that make bones, Beyond that, they're actually quantitatively, there are probably hundreds of thousands of different species preserved in the fossil record that include invertebrates and include vertebrates. But for plants, we tend to get the hard parts preserved, things like wood and things like branches and things like seeds and things like pollen. So it's really difficult to identify a particular species in the fossil record. But plant fossils are very numerous, and especially the hard parts, things that tend to that would be resistant to an axe, for example, were you to chop it down.
Does that give us a distorted view of plant evolution because we only see the hard ones preserved?
It's a lot like the fossil, the view that we get from the fossil record of plants is a lot like the view of, say, dinosaur skin and feathers. The soft parts tend not to preserve. So the fossil record of petals, for example, flower petals, very scant compared to the fossil record of wood. Yeah, there actually are some. And through some really careful work by a number of paleobotanists worldwide, people have found all sorts of different records, but we get these little glimpses into it. So, if you wanted to spend your dissertation studying the evolution of flower petals from the perspective of the fossil record, you might want to choose a different project. There's not much of a record there. But if you want to study the evolution of wood, for example, which is a lot of what I do, we have a long fossil record of things like wood.
Are there hot spots for finding plant fossils? I know there are certain areas of the globe where if you're looking for fish fossils or dinosaur fossils, there are specific places to go. Is the same true of plants?
Yeah, we get these kinds of deposits, and there's a great German word to describe these sorts of famous deposits. It's called a Lagerstätte, which is basically just means roughly translated into the sort of vernacular, it's basically a deposit where we have spectacular preservation of fossils, things like Archaeopteryx, the flying dinosaur, and we have a number of them around the globe. There's a famous hot spring deposit in Scotland called the Rhynie Chert that's near the town of Aberdeen that it's basically a little Yellowstone ecosystem preserved, but it's 400 million years old. And so this particular deposit captures a sort of snapshot of the early evolution of plants as they evolve from algae in the ocean and are sort of transitioning onto land. So we have a number of those, and those are really well studied and incredibly important for understanding the history of plant evolution. So a lot of paleobotanists will focus their energy on some of these deposits to try to learn as much as we can from places where, you know, we have not just the plants preserved, but we have the insects that were crawling on them.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Are these also hot spots for animals so that you get to see the whole ecosystem?
Yeah, some of these, the Rhine Chert in particular is this beautiful fossil hotspot where, you know, we have insects that are preserved on the inside of these plants. So insects that are chewing on the insides of plants or all sorts of early arthropods crawling out of the ocean and living in this early terrestrial ecosystem. It's really it's a snapshot of what the world looked like 400 million years ago.
Wow. In case you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Wilson of Haverford College. When did plants first arise?
So our first record of land plants, it's sort of an ambiguous view. We have this kind of glimpse into early terrestrial plants. And as you know, some of you probably are familiar, plants originated from algae living in the ocean and evolved to colonize land. And we have a beautiful set of fossils from about 475 million years ago that were discovered from work done by an oil company in Libya, where when they were drilling a core to drill oil, some of the scientists noticed that in and among these deposits, they have little records, these little organs that preserve spores of early land plants. And it looks like they're actually encased in such a way that they're closely related to what we would know, what we have today, are small, early diverging land plants like liverworts and mosses. And so that's our best time tie point to when plants transitioned onto land. And earlier before then, we get these little glimpses of small small pollen and spores that are sort of scattered throughout the fossil record. So the time point is we're looking about the last 475 million years, and since that time, you know, plants, you know, started as small, you know, 1 centimeter, 2 centimeter, you know, green photosynthetic things living on the land, and they evolved into large tree-like structures, and then finally forests that we have about 360 million years ago.
So I have small children, and we have this one song that's the 6 plant parts, which is how I always know the definition of a plant, and it's roots, stems, leaves, flowers, fruits, and seeds. Now, that's what defines a modern plant, but clearly that didn't just spring out of nowhere. What plant parts seem to come first?
So what we have in these first early land plants, and we only have the reproductive structures preserved on these from these early plants, what we tend to see is little reproductive structures. And then when we finally get a glimpse of what the actual plant looked like and not just the spores that they shed, they're basically green photosynthetic sticks. You know, they you would look right past them in a flower shop. You would
look leaves.
No, no leaves. They tend to be just like almost like a pencil tube. That's would have been green and photosynthesizing on the outside. And then over the sort of middle of the Paleozoic era, plants evolved more and more branching structures that kind of looked like claws. They're these three-dimensional branching structures that are functionally leaves, but they didn't evolve the sort of classic flat leaf, you know, that you would make a rubbing for. And then all of a sudden, about 360, 370 million years ago, a number of different plant groups evolved leaves independently at about the same time.
How unusual or surprising is it that you would get leaves arising independently multiple times? I mean, we usually think of evolution as one species comes up with some great new innovation and then it spreads to everywhere, but this popped up a bunch of different places, you're saying.
Yeah, the evolution, the multiple origins of leaves and the sort of simultaneous nature of this is a really interesting ecological and physiological and developmental question. And it's something that a number of groups from these sort of modern biologists or modern developmental biologists and paleobotanists have talked about and discussed for a long, long time. And it looks like we have leaves evolve in at least 3 or 4 different groups, probably about the same time during the late Devonian period.
What was going on during that time that might have prompted all of these leaves to suddenly develop?
Yeah, the trigger for this is actually, it's a very interesting question. A number of people have argued that at this time there was a drop in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and so plants and different plant groups evolved in response the form of a laminar leaf to allow increase more photosynthetic area to absorb more CO2 from the atmosphere as CO2 is falling, because plants constantly need carbon dioxide to fix it into organic carbon through photosynthesis. And I think that's probably one of the prevailing explanations, is that there was some environmental trigger that caused not just early seed plants to evolve leaves, but also a number of different fern groups that are living at the same time also evolve leaves.
Now, having these flat leaves, as you say, gives more surface area for absorbing carbon dioxide. But also on the flip side of that, that means you've got more surface area to lose water. And one of the things that you study a lot is how plants move water around. Is there some fundamental limit or something that leads all of these different leaves to kind of end up looking very similar?
You know, the driving force that gives us what we would call convergent form in leaf shape is really, plants all sort of do the same thing to one degree or another. They trade water for carbon. And so as plants, plants have a very hydrated and wet interior. And so plants have a cuticle, so structure on the outside of their leaves, that is covered with these small apertures called stomata, these little mouths that open and close in response to absorbing CO2. And when they open their stomata, they lose water from the inside of their leaves, and they absorb CO2 from the atmosphere. And this is, you can think of it as kind of an economic problem that plants have to balance. They have to absorb enough water from the environment in order to allow them to open their leaves and absorb CO2 from the atmosphere. And over hundreds of millions of years, plants are optimizing all the nature of their vascular system to maximize water transport and water supply in order to absorb CO2 from the atmosphere. And so we tend to find that the reason that a lot of leaves look the same is that there's very similar physiological constraints. There's only a certain number of ways that you can move water to leaves, and you can think of leaves as kind of like irrigating a field. You have a sort of limit to how you can arrange water pathways through a field in order to make sure that every cell, or in this analogy, every plant, is getting enough water from the source, from the vascular system.
Now, to even get the water to the leaves, though, you've got to, as you say, use the vascular system inside the stem. You've mm-hmm. got xylem and phloem, two of my favorite words in all of biology. But I have to tell you, I can never keep straight which one's going up and which one's coming down. So remind us, what is that vascular system of plants?
Yeah, the xylem and phloem, the classic vocabulary words that many people remember from high school or middle school biology. These are two coupled parts of the plant vascular system, where xylem is essentially a network of plumbing. It's a set of cells that are empty and that function as pipes that allow water to move from the soil up through the stem, out through the branches, into the leaves. And it's coupled to a set of tissues, a set of cells called phloem, which move photosynthate, or organic carbon in the form of sugar, down from the leaves, down through the stem, down to the roots. And so these two systems work together. And unfortunately, phloem actually is not particularly well preserved in the fossil record, because it tends to be full of sugar. So as soon as a plant dies, bacteria and fungi will swarm through a plant and chew up and decay the phloem. But xylem, on the other hand, these are pipes that are reinforced with a biopolymer called lignin. And this makes them very hard and very well suited to transporting water. It also means that they're very well preserved in the fossil record. So a lot of my research is studying the architecture of xylem through plants, looking at how big these cells are, how long are these cells, how do they connect with other cells in the stem. And because it's a plumbing system, the physics of that was actually worked out more than 100 years ago for thinking about things like sewage systems and water transport. And so what I do for my research is study xylem through some of this kind of 19th century math, where we calculate and we look at, okay, here's some xylem cells that we find in a plant that's 320 million years old. How fast could water move from the roots up through the stem to the leaves? What's the water supply rate look like? And can that help us understand how fast the plant could grow? Because to a first order, the more water that you can move up through the plant to the leaves, the more CO2 you can absorb from the atmosphere and the faster you can grow. So it's a little bit like being able to look at the bones from a Neanderthal or the bones from a woolly mammoth and know something very critical about its physiology. You know, what is this Neanderthal's heart rate from looking at its bones? So we get that sort of insight from looking at the xylem of these extinct plants.
Now, you call this the vascular system. We, of course, have our own cardiovascular system. And I was really interested in reading through a couple of your papers talking about how drought actually kills plants. I'd never thought about the actual process, just figured, oh, well, there's not enough water, they can't live. But you start using these words that are very reminiscent of human medical biology, again, that you actually get embolisms within the plant in drought conditions. How does that work?
Yeah, there are actually some quantitative and qualitative similarities between the way that the vascular system of plants works and the way that the vascular systems of humans work. And there's a lot of research that's been done to quantify flow rates through, you know, human through the human vascular system, for example, or looking at embolisms propagating through humans, because obviously, you know, from a medical perspective, that's a really terrible thing that can happen to a person. And for plants, it's the same. It's a very similar problem. So we have this vascular system that's working through plants. And the way that the vascular system works is that as the leaf is in the sun and as the leaf dries out, it actually pulls water up through the plant from the roots through the stem to the leaf. So it's
right. There's no pump at the bottom like our heart.
Exactly. Yeah. So in some ways, the architecture of the vascular system is very similar, but it's being driven by different forces. In plants, you can think of it as being pulled out through the leaf instead of being pumped from the center of the heart. But like humans and like animal vascular systems, you know, plants exist in air. There's a lot of air around for plants. And if an air bubble enters the system, because it's being pulled, the air bubble will enter and then expand, and it will pop and it will block it. And actually, everybody has a sort of intuitive sense of what this process is like, because as you drink a drink through a straw in a glass, as you get down to the end and you're drinking, you start to hear pops from air bubbles entering the straw. It makes that sort of annoying noise of somebody slurping on a straw.
The noise that my kids love to make.
Oh, of course. And, you know, as a child, I loved this too, and I didn't realize it was forecasting my scientific career. So as this, what you're essentially doing is you're embolizing the stream of water being drawn up through the straw, and these pops can happen to plants too. And if the water supply is limited, air bubbles will enter, and then it will block the vascular system. And this is actually one of the things that happens when you leave a plant. You know, if you go on vacation and somebody doesn't water your plants, you know, it's not only that, you know, the plant doesn't get turned or, you know, isn't sitting in a nice pool of water and isn't stagnating, but if you don't water it, it will actually embolize. The vascular system will be filled with air bubbles. And this is a problem for plants. Plants work very hard to minimize and contain the damage from embolisms.
I guess I'd always just thought you see the plant kind of drooping or wilting. There's not enough water, essentially, like not enough blood pressure to hold it up. And I just figured that was the process. And I'd never really thought about this idea of the embolisms, the air bubbles that could get in there. And even if maybe there is enough water overall, as soon as you get one embolism, you're done.
Yeah, embolisms can propagate through plants and through the different architecture, different xylem cells and different xylem cell morphologies can actually permit embolisms to spread really far, very quickly through plants. It can also contain embolisms so that if a plant is going to embolize or a plant suffers an embolism event, that can actually be localized and contained within the xylem. So different plants have sort of adopted different strategies over time. But fundamentally, the plant starts wilting and photosynthesis stops when so much of the xylem is embolized that the water supply to leaves can't be maintained.
That's Jonathan Wilson, Assistant Professor of Biology at Haverford College. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break.
Root stems, leaves, love, fruits, and seeds. 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 That's six parts, six parts, six plant parts that plants and people need.
This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with plant biologist Jonathan Wilson of Haverford College. Wilson studies the evolution of plants and often turns to extinct plant species for insight. Jonathan, you mentioned earlier that in some ways you use math based to study the fossil plants that you look at, but also that you kind of try to bring them to life. You actually on your website say you reanimate extinct plants. What does that involve? Are you building models of fossil plants?
When I say that we reanimate extinct plants, what we're trying to do is, as anybody who, you know, is currently going through fall in the Northern Hemisphere knows, plants fall apart. And this is a problem in the fossil record where we have leaves that are separate from trunks, that are separate from roots. And one of the processes that my lab tries to design is actually we take these different plant organs and we try to put them back together, but put them back together in a functional way. We study the xylem architecture and we use mathematical models to look at how quickly could water move through this stem? How quickly could water move through this leaf? We study aspects of leaf morphology and differentiated cells on the leaves to try to understand how did this plant actually work altogether, and what can we understand about its physiology and its development? So we take these plants that have been, you know, existing as disarticulated organs in slabs and museums all over the globe, and try to connect them back together and think and ask a question: what did this plant actually do when it was alive? This plant had to have lived, and how did it actually work?
I mean, are you creating though physical models, like when we go to a museum and see a model of a dinosaur that was, you know, put back together from fossilized bones?
What we try to do is, using chemistry and using math, we try to make observations that can help inform those reconstructions. And unfortunately, you know, my artistic skills are not nearly as good as you'd want them to be. But what we can do is we can use chemistry and use math to try to connect these plants back together and say, okay, this plant probably looked much like this particular fern that grows in southern Australia, for example, or this particular plant looks like more like a climbing palm that grows in New Guinea than the way that it's been reconstructed. And so we try to use statistical methods to try to actually put these plants back together. And then once we have them, one of the goals is to understand how quickly these plants could grow and what environments they could grow in and what environments they couldn't grow in, to try to think about, what do these ecosystems actually look like?
What are some of the weirdest fossil plants that you've ever encountered, perhaps total dead ends that were just bizarre and didn't work out?
Oh, we have the sort of fossil plant freak show is long and is very interesting. There are so many that I could talk about, but I think probably the group that over a long period of time has the most interesting morphologies and some of the real head scratchers are the ferns. Actually, there are a number of extinct ferns that, when you find them in the fossil record, at first you're able to look at them and you're saying, okay, this looks somewhat like a living fern. But then when you look at the internal anatomy, they're the opposite of what you would expect from the outside. And to give you an example, there are a couple of tree ferns that are extinct. One is called Ceronius and one is called Tempskia, and they both lived, one lived about 300 million years ago, another one lived about 200 million years ago, so much farther back in geologic time than most of the dinosaurs. And these tree ferns would actually grow essentially leaves and roots on top of one another, and they would sort of stack on one another like blocks, and they would form these large mounds that could be anywhere from 3 feet tall to more than 6 or 10 feet tall. And so when they're preserved in the fossil record in a volcanic event or a volcanic ash bed, you know, from the outside and from, you know, far away across a museum hallway, it looks like a tree trunk. It looks like just any other tree trunk that you would see. But when you have the internal anatomy preserved and you slice them in half and look down on it, as you look, there are roots and there are stems all jumbled together. And this was essentially a plant that was developing new leaves, and it almost looks like it was cannibalizing itself. And of course, that's not exactly how plants work, but it would be as if you were to take a tree in your front yard, chop it down, look down, and instead of expecting wood, there are a ton of roots from leaves that were growing up on the top of the tree that just grew down through the stem as it was alive.
Completely disorganized.
Very disorganized. And there have been some great papers where people have tried to trace the different roots to the leaves and actually connect these plants back together and say, okay, this leaf was connected to this root, this leaf was connected to this root. And they're very, very interesting. They're truly strange plants.
Really bizarre. Now, in contrast, though, there are some ferns still alive today that seem to have remained virtually unchanged for tens of millions of years. So what makes those particular ferns so successful and gives them such staying power?
Oh, that's a really interesting ecological and evolutionary question. Exactly what, you know, why do we have some of these kinds of living fossils of plants? Some of it, I think, is just the sort of stochastic nature of evolution. There are lineages that are extremely successful. There are lineages that occupy a niche, and the niche was much greater and then has gradually shrunk. The classic example of this is Ginkgo biloba, the ginkgo plant. Ginkgos were once widespread across the globe, and there's a great fossil record of ginkgos that goes back 240 million years, if not further. But we have one species that's around today, and its range has been gradually shrunk until it was, you know, a small restricted range in East Asia. And I think some of these ferns, it's just they're extremely good at what they do, and they've been in an environment that's been conducive to their growth, and they just managed to hang on. You know, they're well adapted to their own particular environment.
There are ferns have this other odd feature, which is that they are really good at accumulating silicon.
Mm-hmm.
More than almost any other living plant group, if I read this correctly. What are they doing with all that silicon?
The plants absorbing silica from the environment and using minerals to build skeletons is a very interesting process that people have known about for a long time. But my lab has started studying this to try to think about long-term evolution of what we call biogeochemical cycles. So things like the carbon cycle or things like the iron cycle on Earth or the nitrogen cycle. So it's an elemental cycle that both Earth processes and biological processes participate in. And so ferns and a lot of these other, what we would call early diverging or primitive lineages of plants, a number of them actually accumulate this silica from the environment. And silica is essentially silica bodies are essentially a poorly crystalline form of glass that plants absorb silicic acid from the environment, from soils. And these particular plants, whereas most plants don't absorb it and they just leave it in the soil, these plants actually absorb it through their vascular system and then deposit it in their structure. And it can be 8 to 10% of some of the weight of these particular plants. So it would be as
really?
If... Yeah, it's a very high number. And so some of these plants, like horsetails, for example, the common name for the genus, one of the species of the genus Equisetum is called the scouring rush. It's actually widespread around Massachusetts in bog environments. It can be 8% silica. I mean, that would be as if, your forearm were entirely made of glass. A large component of a plant's body is actually...
Does that make them particularly... crunchy and brittle? I mean, do they feel kind of like glass?
Oh, you can feel that. And when you hold these plants that are silicon accumulators, for most of them, you can actually tell. You can hold them and rub them. And they are rough enough that Equisetum species in particular, for a long time, were used as sort of kitchen scouring plants. You could grab them and use them to scrub pots that are actually where there's baked on food or something like that. They're tough enough to work as like steel wool, but growing outside.
Now, you mentioned this idea of a global silica cycle, which I can't say that I'd ever thought of a silica cycle other than maybe coastal erosion and sand moving around. What happens when these plants accumulate the silica? What goes on from there?
So the way that plants participate in the silica cycle and this sort of global cycle of elemental silica, by now a lot of people are familiar with the carbon cycle, but there are all sorts of other elemental cycles that are going on in parallel, and it's like different gears in a machine that all sort of connect at different spatial and different temporal scales. And one of the interesting things about the silica cycle is that there's a set of phytoplankton out of the ocean called diatoms that actually make shells out of silica. So these are photosynthetic algae, and they make little tiny shells that are made out of silica. And silica is a necessary nutrient for diatoms. Without silica, they don't grow. And without them growing, they don't absorb CO2 and fix it into organic carbon. So for diatoms that are living out in the ocean, they tend to get silica through one of two ways. One is through dust storms off of big, large wind events from the Sahara Desert, for example. Dust blows into the middle of the Atlantic, and you get a diatom bloom that grows
up
from there.
So that's sand, basically, silica from sand.
Yeah, silica from sand, and the sand dissolves in the ocean and provides silica to the diatoms. For some of these plants, like grasses... that absorb a lot of silica, when these plants die and they decay in a watershed or their leaves get transported down the Mississippi River, as the organic matter decays, the silica is released to the ocean too. And so plants actually provide a number of a quantitatively large amount of silica to these primary producers in the ocean that then in turn absorb CO2 from the atmosphere. So by looking at the silica cycle and looking at how plants participate in the silica cycle, we can start thinking of some very sort of long-term questions. For example, as climate continues to change in North America, we have a huge grassland that's partly planted over with corn and other grass, but also native grasses all over the Great Plains. If climate changes that makes it hostile to these grasses, what happens then to the silica that these grasses are currently absorbing through the soil and then getting transported down the Mississippi River to the diatoms? How does that change the silica cycle? And then how does that affect, in turn, the carbon cycle of the ocean? And so we were thinking about these questions, and we decided that we wanted to actually ask the long-term question of how long have plants actually been participating in this silica cycle? And it turns out that with these lineages of ferns that evolved, 350, 360 million years ago, plants have actually been absorbing silica for a long, long time. Precisely why is another set of questions that we're working to answer.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Jonathan Wilson, assistant professor at Haverford College, about his research on the evolution of plants. A little bit of a different direction here, but we've talked on this show over the past year or two a lot about the emerging field of research on the diversity of bacteria that live in our guts, on our skin, all around us, the good bacteria around us. And you've kind of dived into this with the bacteria that live on the leaves of plants. Tell us about that.
So there are a number of microbiomes, and it's really thrilling to see this the microbiome research enter the popular consciousness. And one of the aspects of this that my lab explores is what's called the phylosphere. So this is the you can think of a leaf as a mini ecosystem or a microenvironment that bacteria have colonized. And this all comes from I was really struck by an image that I saw once as a graduate student that a colleague of mine, Alex Bradley, presented of he had taken a leaf and pressed it into a plate, a petri dish of agar, and just let it grow, and had seen all these bacteria that grew up. And it was there were so many bacteria on this leaf that you could actually see the outline of the leaf morphology. And this was an image that stuck in my head for many years. You know, I've been thinking about leaves and studying leaves and thinking about them from the perspective of the fossil record for a long, long time. And this image, I just couldn't shake this image. And when I took this position at Haverford College, I was lucky to co-teach with a microbiologist, my former colleague at Haverford, Iruka Okeke, who's now in Nigeria. And she and I were teaching a class, and we could choose whatever subject we wanted to investigate. And this image just sort of reoccurred to me, and I asked Iruka, you know, maybe we should explore the bacteria that are living on plant leaves. What do we know about this? And it turns out that the diversity of bacteria that live on plant leaves is almost as diverse as the amount of bacteria and archaea and eukaryotes that live in the human gut.
Really?
They're an extremely diverse mini ecosystems, and it you know, some of the bacteria are just using the leaf as a, you know, a bright shiny place in the sun that occasionally gets water from the atmosphere, but some of them are actually interacting with leaves. You know, of course, some of them are leaf pathogens, but some of them are actually feeding on organic carbon or absorbing water that's being lost from the leaves. They're sort of occupying these little humid spaces on the undersides of leaves. And it's an extraordinarily diverse ecosystem. And so part of our work at Haverford has been to explore the diversity and ask, you know, what does this community look like? What are the rare bacteria that are living there? And what are they doing for the plant, or what is the plant doing for them?
How does that diversity compare to what we might find on the roots? Because I think that's where you might intuitively think there would be so many bacteria is down in the soil and on the roots.
Oh, soil and roots are filled with bacteria. And compared to roots, leaves are actually not nearly as diverse. But I think everybody's been surprised by the amount of the diversity of bacteria that we do find on leaves. Everything from rare bacteria that are absorbing and decaying the leaves or feeding off of small carbon compounds in the wood. It's an extraordinarily diverse and complex ecosystem on these leaves.
So many ecosystems at this point have been touched by humans, at least a little bit. Do you see any of that? I mean, are there bacteria that we might associate with human skin or something like that that you now find on leaves? Do we have a sense of whether maybe trees in cities have more human bacteria on their leaves than more pristine forests?
You know, it's an interesting question about what's the source of the bacteria on these leaves, and does it change from place to place? It's a very interesting question, and I think the research that people have done in the phylosphere is still fairly early in its stages in characterizing these sorts of differences as something that a lot of people are working on. But one of the things we found is we've particularly found on some leaves bacteria that are used as sort of natural herbicides. So these are bacteria that are treated, that are sprayed on lawns or golf courses. When they're sprayed onto these particular leaves, they tend to travel. They'll migrate as the wind blows. And so in areas where they haven't been used to treat plants, we found them, and they're probably coming from nearby golf courses or nearby well-maintained lawns or, you know, somebody's orchard or something like that.
So what happens on your lawn doesn't necessarily stay on your lawn.
Doesn't necessarily stay there. Bacteria are experts at moving with small gusts of wind or rainstorms. And so what you apply in one particular place will almost certainly not stay there.
Now, you have an ongoing project in this realm looking at rare bacteria on conifer leaves. Why those in particular?
One of the interesting things about conifers is their leaves tend to be fairly small. Pine needles, junipers, their leaves are fairly small. And there's an idea sort of out in the world that conifer leaves have really thick cuticle. They're not particularly good food for herbivores. And that's part of the secret to conifer success is that, you know, things don't really like to eat conifer leaves. And we are fortunate at Haverford to have a really world-class arboretum staff. And we happen to have a really extraordinarily diverse set of conifers on campus. And my colleague Aruka and I decided that we would decide to contribute to the phylosphere literature by studying conifers. And, you know, here's a group of plants that from the perspective of a lot of other scientists, their leaves aren't very interesting. And so we wanted to know what was actually growing on these so-called boring leaves. And we've had some students who have started exploring these particular leaves and have found all sorts of interesting bacteria that grow on them. And a number of them grow extremely slow. And so what we've done is you take the leaves and you essentially shake them in a sonicator, and the bacteria get jostled off the leaf. And then you apply them on a petri dish, let them sit in the sun for a couple of weeks, and sure enough, you get this spectacular arrangement of colors and shapes that appear. And we've had students who've worked on them who've described a whole number of interesting bacteria, and a number of them have actually not been described previously in the scientific literature.
Very exciting. That's Jonathan Wilson, plant biologist at Haverford College. I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. There are plant species that have gone virtually unchanged over the course of tens of thousands of years. There are others that have come and gone in the blink of an eye, geologically speaking. Jonathan Wilson of Haverford College thinks he may have an inkling of where today's plants are headed. More on that in a few minutes. Jonathan, how did you first get interested in plant evolution?
I got interested in plant evolution through a kind of circuitous academic route. When I was an undergraduate at Johns Hopkins, I was fortunate enough to, I was working in a computer science program, and I had to take a required science class, and I ended up taking a geology class, and I realized that I was a much better geologist than I ever would be a computer scientist. And so I became interested in the history of life, and was fortunate enough to work with a number of really talented faculty who took me under their wing and showed me the sort of breadth and scope of the history of life and what you could learn from the geologic record. Hope Jaron, Dmitry Sverzhensky, Stephen Stanley. And as I was taking these classes, they allowed me to sit in with graduate students. And a number of these courses were focused on soil science or long-term trends in evolution, but looking at marine invertebrates and things that were made of shells. And I grew up in Southern California, which has a really interesting flora because much of the native California flora is actually quite restricted. We tend to get Australian invasives and things like that, the eucalypts that always catch fire during fire season.
That's just because of like the port of LA and so much coming into Southern California, or why is that?
The environment in Southern California is that Mediterranean climate is actually really well suited for plants if you're willing to irrigate it. And so in the long history of Southern California's water being coming from other places in California and other places out west has allowed people to grow plants there that would not normally grow in the environment, but people like the look of a eucalypt, so they grow it on their lawn. And so I had this sort of image of plant communities in my mind for a long time, but I didn't know anything about plant evolution. And when I went to graduate school, I just decided that this was a set of organisms that, because they're preserved in the fossil record in an anatomical way, I really wanted to understand how they worked. And it was sort of the last latent bit of my sort of engineering background, wanting to tinker and put these plants back together.
Do you ever feel like plants get short shrift, that we take plants for granted and focus all of our effort or attention on animals and things more like ourselves?
I think there's a natural sort of human perspective to sort of identify more with animals, you know, things with eyes and faces. You know, we can see ourselves in them. And, you know, one of the things that's been very interesting over the last couple of years is looking at the food movement. I think writers like Michael Pollan and Mark Bittman, who through the lens of food have, I think, ask people to take plant communities more seriously. The things on your plate that are green and vegetables, you know, treat them and think about them as part of a biodiverse food chain or food ecosystem. And that's been something that, surprisingly, more of my students that I see at Haverford College, this is how they come to plant biology, is through their food and writers like Michael Pollan and Mark Bittman.
Well, of course, they're necessary to all life on Earth. Without the plants, we certainly wouldn't be here. And if you go back hundreds of millions of years, plants are actually responsible for all life on Earth because of the oxygen that they put into the atmosphere. They fundamentally transformed our whole atmosphere. But I wonder, during that transformation, what toll that took on the plants themselves. Was there a die-off or a major change associated in plants as this rise of oxygen in the atmosphere?
You know, that one of the great metabolic innovations is the evolution of oxygenic photosynthesis. So there's a number of ways that you can use photosynthesis to fix carbon or get energy from light. But oxygenic photosynthesis that produces oxygen in the atmosphere is really an incredible metabolism, and it really has changed global surface environments over the last 2.5 billion years. And we do have records of plant extinction in the geologic record. They happen because of a variety of things. There's a some strong impact from for example, the asteroid impact that killed the dinosaurs. That actually caused some local mass extinction in North America for plants. It looks like it's not as uniform as it was with the dinosaurs, but in certain areas you can see major die-offs.
And are plants generally, I mean, we've had 5 mass extinction events, the dinosaurs being one of them. Are plants generally as hard hit as animals in those events?
It depends on the mass extinction, actually. Some mass extinctions, there's a large mass extinction 250 million years ago that is absolutely devastating in the oceans. You know, it's called the Permian-Triassic mass extinction. And we're looking at about, from a marine perspective, 80 to 85% of marine species or even more go extinct. On land, the record's a bit more complex. We do see it in a lot of places that there's pervasive extinction. You know, an ecological community that exists on land goes extinct and never comes back. But it's a little bit more complex. Certain extinctions actually hit animals harder than they do plants. And certain events, tectonic events, for example, when North America and Western Europe collide, you know, are devastating to plants because you go from being a lowland tropical wetland like Louisiana or like the mouth of the Mississippi River to being high up in the mountains and dry, you know, and that's devastating to plant ecosystems where animals can just pick up and move.
What is the sense of the extinction rate of plants today? I mean, there's a growing consensus that we're maybe moving into a 6th mass extinction event caused by humans. Again, most of the attention gets focused on the animals that are going extinct. Are we seeing that kind of extinction rate in plants?
I think the idea that we're undergoing a 6th major mass extinction event is absolutely true, and you do see it in plant communities. You see it in a variety of ways. It's not just rare species that are being lost. You know, for example, under deforestation, you not only lose the big trees, but there are a lot of small plants that actually live on these large trees. And so these rare populations of things like orchids are almost certainly going extinct along as these larger ecological changes actually happen. But one of the things we're seeing actually today is we're seeing a lot of invasive species. So as people move around the globe and as humans plant exotic plants in different places, you can have a plant that evolved, you know, for example, in southern China that when planted in Florida outcompetes every plant there. And so it can cause a local extirpation or even an extinction of native flora. And this is something that conservation biologists, I think, are very concerned about because these are dynamic communities in a sense. And the issue is the rate of change that humans are imposing on the environments around them. And it's just as shocking, I think, for plants as it is for, you know, larger and more charismatic animals.
With climate change, there are a couple of different effects that could affect plants in different ways. One that in some cases, those who don't want to do anything about climate change bring up as an argument is there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now. That's food for plants. Plants should love this. Are we seeing that?
The argument that, and you see this frequently, from politicians, is CO2 is plant food. And while that's true, that's also trivially true, which is in some ways the least important kind of true. It is true that plants actually benefit from CO2. The problem is plants require a number of other nutrients and a number of other substances to make them grow, including water, including nitrogen, including phosphorus, and including a whole host of other minor nutrients. And so feeding plants more CO2, while from just the perspective of carbon and strictly the perspective of carbon, is helpful to them, that can cause cascades of other limiting nutrients, limited nitrogen or limited phosphorus. And CO2 can also acidify things like rainwater and things like soils. And that can also cause problems for plants. But by far the most important problem is temperature. Plants are very sensitive to temperature. I mean, there's a reason why plants that thrive in Florida, you know, do not do so well when planted in, say, upper Maine. And so by changing temperature and by changing it so rapidly, you know, we're talking years and decades, not centuries, millennia, or tens of thousands of years like plant communities are used to, that's something that, you know, the rate of change is probably far too high for many ecosystems. And so while if you ignore water and you ignore temperature and you ignore limiting nutrients and you ignore all these other factors, yeah, more CO2 could be okay for plants. It simply is outweighed by all these other issues.
I saw a report recently from, I believe it was the Public Policy Institute of California, talking about the impacts of the drought there. And they actually mentioned the possibility of local extinctions of certain animal but also plant species because of this drought. How concerned are you about that?
Well, it's something that, you know, you can be concerned about it. And, you know, as a native of Southern California, you know, when you travel back to California in a severe drought year like this year, you know, you get used to seeing drier lawns, you get used to seeing, you know, more dead plant material. But I think the shocking thing to me has been observing dead trees is something that's very shocking to me when going back. Trees tend to have large and complex root systems so that even if it's been dry for several months or even if it's been terribly dry and terribly hot, grasses will die back to the soil, but trees will be able to tap into groundwater and survive the dry period. And seeing dry trees in California, or dry and dead trees, is really something that's quite shocking.
You take the long view on plants, hundreds of millions of years in the fossil record. When you see something like those dead trees or the possibility of extinctions of plant species, does that long-term perspective provide comfort that perhaps this has happened before, it will happen again, extinction happens? Or does it make you perhaps even more concerned?
You know, I'd like to think that it would allow me to step back and be sort of comforted and you know, take the longer view that this is just another mass extinction in the long history of, you know, plants and animals interacting with the environment. But it's troubling. You know, I think, you know, you could think of it as, you know, how exciting, you're living through one of these major mass extinction events on Earth, but actually seeing it from the ground's eye view, from the ground, and being able to watch these changes, you know, day by day and year by year, it's troubling.
These rapid changes, you said, for many species may be too much and we may see extinctions, but those rapid changes can also force evolution. Do you have a sense, based on your observation of the past evolution of plants, what kinds of directions, what kinds of innovations might we see beginning to thrive and emerge?
Yeah, what predicting is always a hard, it's always a difficult thing in the evolution game, because you're thinking about rate and there are all these other factors that are going on. But I think one of the things that we'd expect to see over the next 100 or 150 years are some of these plants that are successful invasives, I think they'll continue to do well. So some of these plants that rapidly disperse their seeds or grow very rapidly and sort of strangle other plants or outcompete
other
plants.
What's an example?
A kudzu in the south is a classic example. And if any of you who've driven Interstate 95 down through North Carolina and South Carolina, you look to either side and you can see it. These kinds of invasive species, I think, will continue to do well in the world that we're creating for them. I think other plants that are slower growing, things like sequoias, things like giant redwoods, those will probably not do so well. And so we might see a world where we have the faster, rapid breeding, sort of live fast, die young plant architecture that will probably be successful in the coming decades.
What about those ferns that have been around for so long?
It's a good question. Some of these, can they, you know, they've hung on through so many mass extinctions. Can they hang on through this mass extinction? It's hard to predict. Some species, I think, will do quite well. There's some equisetum, these horsetail species that accumulate silica. Some of them are actually quite good at growing. They propagate through under the soil. They actually grow roots out and then shoot up aerial structures from their roots. Some of them may continue to do so well. Some of them that live in particular microclimates or environments probably not do so well. And so see them while you can, enjoy them while you can, would probably be my advice.
That's Jonathan Wilson. He's assistant professor of biology at Haverford College. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.